Hello everyone, we are starting a new year by the new starting of the reading from Bereshit. And as I say every year, there's no way I can explain what is Parashat Bereshit, the story of Bereshit, in 1 hour, because the Zohar has about 3 volumes about the portion of Bereshit, and it has few more volumes just the word Bereshit. Because if the word Bereshit is the first word of the Torah, it concludes the whole Torah. Just remember that. So reading the story of the creation, we have to understand that this is a story that it takes many, many lifetimes to unlock. It's not just that few commentators we can explain it, and that's why when we come to read the story of the creation, we understand that it is a very tough job to understand it. And basically, we have to cut ways that if I want to understand something like this, I need to do a lot of work and to give it a lot of time. And not to jump to conclusions. Because we'll read the story, we'll see how the Torah, as usual, put in the obvious all kinds of hints that is a lot of not obvious things in it. This is the Bereshit bara Elokim, and in the beginning, which is such a poor translation of the word Bereshit, whoever knows Hebrew, because the word Bereshit is so not in the beginning. It has a lot of things, as we said, it has many, many volumes in the Zohar just about the word Bereshit. Okay? But let's go to the translation again. So God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was and there's a lot of, you know, every word over here it's a tough thing to translate. In this translation, for it says in the traditional translation it says that the earth was chaos, right? And chaos. Here they understand that it is a wrong translation, and it says the earth was astonishingly empty, which is the translator over here tried to already explain to us that that's what it does, not what it says in the Hebrew. And tohu vavohu, you can understand it in many ways, but that it was astonishingly empty, it already explains the word chaos is not a translation. So what does it say? And the Spirit of God was hovering above the water, and God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated between the light and the darkness, and God called the light day, and to the darkness he called night. And then it says, and there was an evening. And then there was a morning, one day. Not first day, one day. Now, why one day? That was the first day, correct? And what does it mean that God created the light? We know that the light that we know is coming from the sun, correct? Even if I look at the light of electricity, the light of the electricity is coming from the power station. The power station is working on kind of fuel, either coal or petroleum fuel, right? So, but that was made from vegetation that made it from the light of the sun, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the light, unless your power is coming from a nuclear reactor or something like this, but you know. But the light was created when? On the fourth day. On the fourth day. Only on the fourth day it says, and God said, "Let there be." How does it translate over here? And there was, and God said, "Let there be luminaries in the firmament of the heaven." So, and that's how, and that, listen carefully. To separate between the day and the night. Didn't we do it already in the first day? Why do you have to reinvent the wheel? It was already created. And then those luminaries will look for signs and for holidays and for days and for years. Okay, and then it says, and God made the two big luminaries, the big one for the day and the small one for the night and the stars. And here comes the question. If it says that God created the two big luminaries, how come in the same sentence he says the big one and the small one? Did we say that both were big? We just said in the beginning of the sentence. Did we say both are big? It says, and God created the two luminaries. Shnei ha-me'orot ha-gdolim. So the two big ones, right? And then in the same sentence, so it continues. The big one for the day and the small one for the night. We said two big ones. Contradiction, right? Okay. So let's go from the beginning. Because if you go, usually when you ask a rabbi, how do I study the stories of the Torah? They'll tell you, read the Torah and then read the commentary of Rashi. Rashi was a great, great sage. He lived in France 1,000 years ago. Okay? And he wrote a commentary to the Bible and to the Talmud that is indisputable. Like, nobody will dare to say that Rashi said something wrong. But when we see what Rashi says about this, for instance, and these are the most famous, because it says, how does Rashi answer this question? Why God forgot that he said that it was a bit two big ones and he made one big and one small? Does he have kind of amnesia? No. So Rashi is bringing a story. And he says as follows. Let me see, where is the story coming from? It says, it's coming from the Talmud, Tractate Chulin, page 60, side B. And it says as follows. In the beginning, really, God created two big luminaries. And the moon was the same size as the sun. But then came the moon to God. That's what Rashi says. The moon came to God and says, is it nice that two kings are going to use the same crown? Something's wrong with it. God says to the moon, you know, you have a good idea. Go and diminish yourself. So the moon says, I came with a good idea and I have to pay for it? So God said, you know, we'll bring every new moon, we'll bring a special burnt offering for you for atonement for that thing and so, but you go and diminish yourself. Now, how do you take this story for the explanation that God in the beginning created two big luminaries and the moon is now smaller than the sun? Have an easier way to explain it. It says, no, God really meant the two big ones relatively to the other stars, that the bigger one. Isn't that the easier way to get out of the problem? Correct? Without getting into a bigger problem, because, oh, now I got the understanding there were two big ones, but the moon had a problem with that. And the moon was punished. And that's why the moon is smaller, right? Makes sense. Right? That really makes sense? Correct? To everyone. I think even a 6-year-old won't take it. Today, now there's not, and I'm not so sure in ancient times kids will take it. Although, you know what? Kids do take it. If you tell them nonsense when they're kids, they don't judge. No. They get used to it. And that's how we are. The nonsense when we're kids, and we grew up with it. And we grew up with it. So the same question is, how, you know, I think lots of kids are studying Genesis. Right? You study Genesis, the story of the creation. If you go to a religious kindergarten, you're going to learn about the story of the creation already in the kindergarten. Right? Grade 1, grade 2. In Israel, grade 2. You have to start, even if you're not religious. You have to start to learn the Bible, because that's the book of this country, right? Where are you going to learn Hebrew from? From the Bible. So a kid opens the Bible and it speaks in his language. He's 7 years old, too, and he understands the language. It's not that different than modern Hebrew, correct? And he reads the story and never asks the question, how come God created the light on the first day, but he created the sun only on the fourth day? So how could it be there was a night and there was a day? One day, second day, third day, but there was no sun. How could that be? Did you ever ask yourself the question? Yes, anybody here? Did you ask yourself the question?
No. A day wasn't a day as we know it.
So, but it says there was a night and there was a day. Yes. So if you are a kid, you don't ask yourself the question? I didn't ask the question because I was a kid. I studied it. And because the way you hear it, you assume that the grown-ups, they know. If they don't tell you there's a problem with it, you take it as it is. Right? You hear a story about dragons and so. There are stories with dragons and stuff like this. You don't question it. Correct? And this is the problem. That's why you have to start to, many Kabbalists say you have to start to study Kabbalah when you're a kid. Because then later on, one day, you grow up and you start to ask the questions and you say the whole thing is nonsense. And you turn your back to it and you go away. Because if this is nonsense, everything is nonsense. So you have to teach understanding from the beginning. So, and then, and Rashi is also relating to the question, so where, if there is a different light coming from the sun than the light that God created in the beginning, so where is this light? Oh, so some people say it's a different light. The sunlight came on the fourth day, before that there was a different light. Right. What does Rashi say about it? So Rashi says as follows. And it says, he brings another legend from the Talmud, Tractate Chagiga, page 12, side 1. And he says, even here we need a legend to explain it. Like Rashi is telling us, no, we need a legend to explain it, because the explanation is beyond the regular logic. And he's saying, in the beginning, God created this, the most enormous, amazing light. That he saw was going to come up with mankind. And he saw there's so many vicious people going to be walking on earth. And they are going to use the light to that amazing, wonderful light he created. So he hid that light only for the righteous people, for the future to come. So people have instead only the regular physical light. So what do we learn of it? That when it says, and God said, let there be light, that light that was created, you cannot see with two eyes. It's a different kind of light. It's a spiritual light. It's a hidden light. It's called Or HaGanuz, the treasured light. This is the light and treasured only for righteous people. People who are not righteous cannot see that light. Okay? Do you buy that legend? What kind of a choice do you have? And what kind of an option do you have? Okay? So, we have a lot of questions. We can ask more. Why didn't God say that? And God said that it was good on the second day. He said it on every day, not on the second day. On the second day, God did not say, and it was good. In return, God said it was good on the third day. Only on the third day. Twice. One for the second, one for the third day. Why? So, we have so many questions we can ask about the creation, and we didn't even just start, because that's only the first few sentences. After that comes the story of the creation of Adam and Eve. And then Cain and Abel, the first two brothers, they kill each other. Right? What an example. They just born. How many families do you know that one brother killed the other? There are some. but this is the first family of men.
Right?
Yeah, it happens. But it's the first, we're talking, because that's the week. It's the week of Bereshit. So things like this do happen. First family of men. And it's really, the family in Hebrew, it's, the word family of men comes from the word in Hebrew, Mishpachat HaAdam. And who is Adam? Adam. The word in Hebrew is Adam. The family of Adam. Who is the family of Adam? We are the family of Adam. How do you say in Hebrew? A human being. You say the name Adam, children of Adam. We are all the children of Adam. Okay, so that's the example this amazing holy book is bringing to us. The first family, the first two children being born, they already kill each other. What kind of hope is left for the rest of humanity? Right? And there is a story of the sin of Adam. And it was, you know, first of all, why it's the sin of Adam? Who ate first from the tree? Eve. Eve ate from the tree and she gave it to Adam. Right? And then what does it say? After that, they opened their eyes. It was a tree of, and they realized they're naked. So they hid. Who did they hide from? Who was there to hide from?
From each other.
From each other? Husband and wife. Are they supposed to hide from each other? So they are hiding from, and then God is looking around and says, where are you? It's like God doesn't know where are they. He's God. Can't sit behind the bushes? Right? And then Adam says, I'm here behind the bushes because I'm ashamed, because I'm naked. Give me a break. This is God. He can't see under your clothes. And by the way, He created you. He midwifed you. So how can you be ashamed of God? That you are... This story doesn't make sense. If you really look at it like this, simply with common eyes, it doesn't make sense. And the snake is seducing Eve. Did you ever meet a talking snake? How high is the IQ of a snake? It can cheat the best woman, Eve. Right? And then, you know what happens the moment that God is taking, is telling Adam, after he said that they, you know, we're ashamed because we're naked. And then what he says, who told you you're naked? Who told you you're naked? How are we supposed to know you're naked? You never seen anybody dressed up, right? Oh, you ate from the tree, I told you not to touch, right? Well, God didn't know that. He didn't know that, but listen to what it says, what it says later on. Did you eat from the tree I told you not to touch from it? What's Adam's answer? The woman you gave to me, she made me eat it. Who is he blaming? Who is he blaming?
Eve.
No. So the woman you gave to me.
He's blaming God.
He's blaming God. So, why would the Torah give us such a story? I'm sure that the people who wrote the book, you know, this is the book of all books, the bestseller of ever in history. Ever, right? Nobody sold, printed more volumes than the Bible in all different languages. Weren't they intelligent enough to realize that this doesn't make sense? If you want to write a bestseller, then make it some more commonsense. And you know what you learn from these few things? One thing, you can sell nonsense to everyone and they'll buy it. That's one thing. Because I'm sure that billions of people in history of mankind that read the book, most of them never even had, the questions never crossed their minds. You can sell the biggest amount of nonsense to people and they will still buy it. Right? People do buy it till today. They buy the nonsense of the interpretations of the Bible, the nonsense of interpretations of religions that are based on the Bible, and the nonsense of politics that is based on the religion that is based on it, and so on and so forth, and people still buy it. And it has to be And people buy, you know, you don't need even the Bible. Then Judaism realized what the Bible realized so many years ago. They'll buy anything. So they write everything in the newspapers, and people will believe most of it. Very few people will question what the newspaper will say. Very few people will question. And the more terrible is the news, the more gullible people will be to believe in it. That's what people are about.
So what is the moral behind this story?
Exactly. So what is the moral behind the story? The moral behind the story, like, first of all, like every story in the Torah, the first moral is that never ever judge by what you see, because it never happens the way you see it. Never. It never ever happens the way you see it, because your sight, the way you see things, makes them be the way you believe in it. And how did we get that power to do that? It's in this parasha also. In this story. In chapter 2, verse 4, it says, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth as they were created on the day that God the Lord created the heaven and the earth. And all the bushes of the field didn't grow up yet. And all the grasses of the field didn't grow up yet. Because God did not bring rain to the earth, and there was no Adam to till the ground. And then God created Adam, soil from the earth." Didn't we say that Adam was created in the first chapter? He was created in the first chapter. Why do we have to start all over again? And to tell us about the creation of Adam. So, some wise guys say, there were two Genesis chapter 1. And when they compiled the whole thing together, some, who knows, more than 2,000, 25 centuries ago, they didn't know what to do, so both compilations of versions of Genesis 1. And one starts, "These are the generations of the heaven and the earth, as they were created." The other one starts, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." Kind of similar. You will notice the difference. Right? If you don't think too much. But, and then he says about that Adam was lonely. Was he lonely? We just read in the previous chapter. And God said, no, it says, "And God created Adam in the image of God. He created him, male and female, he created them." So, when Adam was created, was he created? No, it says, he created male and female, he created them. In the same sentence, it speaks about the creation of Adam. So, why does it have to tell us again the story? And again, we'll see it from here, from these verses. Chapter 2, verse 4. "These are the generations," let me read, "these are the products of the heaven and the earth when they were created on the day that God made earth and heaven. Now all the trees of the field were not yet on the earth, and all the herb of the field had not yet sprouted." Just again, what day did Adam was created? What day was he created on? On the sixth day. The luminaries were created on the fourth day. Adam was created on the sixth day. But let me remind you something. I don't know how much you remember from reading the Bible. You know, I recommend it. It's a bestseller. Okay? And it says, "And God said, let the water..." Professional association. "God said, let the waters beneath the heaven and be gathered into one area. And let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth. And to the gathering of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good, And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, herbage yielding seed, fruit trees yielding fruit, each after its kind, containing its own seed on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, herbage yielding after its kind, and trees yielding fruit, each containing its seed after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a third day. So, what do we learn from here? That the vegetation was created and it sprouted when? On the third day. Adam was created on the sixth day. How come they say that nothing grew before Adam came to water the earth? And what you, which is an amazing idea. You want to tell me that you need people to water the Amazonas? What about the rainforest in Washington state? Is there anybody standing there and watering the rainforest over there? Yes? And what about the so many trees outside over here? Most of them are not being watered. They still grow up. You want to tell me that in ancient times people didn't notice that the trees grew up without us watering them? That the earth is covered with huge forests and not one man is watering them? They get water from the heaven, they will get water from the rivers and the swamps and so on, and then where is this taken from? Enough questions. So the story is like this. We live in a world that we have to understand that this world is made, as it says, and God said, let there be. 10 times God said, let there be. 10 times. Why? The Zohar explains it's the 10 sfiot, which are 10 illuminations, that are illuminating the light from the above, that gives life to everything. Can we connect directly to the light force of God? No, because God is endless light and endless light, and we are finite. And if we connect us or an herb connects directly to the source of life, whoever does it will go burn, will get burnt. Why? It's endless. Endless power. Endless power cannot feed finite entities. Therefore, there are 10 curtains. Between the light of the Creator and our world. And these 10 curtains are called Sefirot. And therefore it says, and God said, let there be, 10 times in the story of Genesis. To show how the light and the power and the force of life, when it comes from God, it has to be through curtains.
Why 10?
And why 10? And it's a whole big story, but why 10? Why 10? Why 10 is a number, and what? How does it bring it to 10? Why we count a decimal, right? We count to 10, and then we start all over again. 11, 12, 13, whatever, and then we come to another 10. 20, 21, 22, 23. Why are we counting 10? Why we have 10 fingers? Right? Why 10? So, it's not for now, but you know, when you learn Kabbalah, you understand how from the light force of God comes out, if you want, someone whose infinite entity of sharing wants to share with someone. Because if you are an entity of sharing, how can you be an entity of sharing if nobody wants to receive from you? It's a problem, right? Therefore, how does an entity of sharing manifest or illuminate or emanate an entity of receiving? You need to go through 10 levels. And this is Kabbalistic, you know, it takes a while to understand how from nothing to something you need to go through 10 levels. But mathematically it works. And that's a whole course by itself. But it's math. It's math. There's only one way, it has to be 10. Okay? By the way, when scientists in 1984 came to the solution of Einstein's biggest dilemma. How do you connect all forces of physics into one equation? They realized that the only way to put all forces of physics together in one equation is realizing 10 dimensions in the universe. the same 10 sefirot of Kabbalah. Okay. The 10 sefirot. And they said maybe 10, maybe 26. And the Kabbalah said the 10 and 26 is the same. Because the name of God, that is the name that is not being pronounced, the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey, you never pronounce it. If you put that together, Yud is 10, Hey is 5, Vav is 6, Hey is 5, together we get 26. And it is contained, it is the symbol of the 10 Sefirot. Of the 10 Sefirot. There is, the Yud has the it's called Kutsosha Yud, the Torah of the Yud. Which is it's an expression in Hebrew. Kutsosha Yud is the Keter, the first Sefirah. The second Sefirah is the Yud. The third is the Hey. The Vav is 6, it has 6 Sefirot, and the last one is Malchut, altogether 10 Sefirot. It's all encoded in the name of God. Okay? So, the Kabbalists have an explanation. You know what? If somebody will come with better explanations than that, maybe I'll take it. But this explanation, the last 30 years, makes it answers all the questions. Because it puts everything together. In science, in psychology, in religion, in history, everything puts together. When you understand it, the whole story is on the code. So when it says, and God said, let there be. Can you ask yourself the question, how did he say if it doesn't have a mouth? How did he say if he does not have a mouth? And God saw it was good. How did he see without eyes? There were no eyes yet. There was no mouth yet. What are you talking about?
Just a way of speaking.
It's a way of speaking, but still, all of these words have a different meaning. It's not just poetry. It's something much deeper than that. And let's go to the key again. When it says that God created on the day, he created all the vegetation, but nothing grew till Adam came. Does it remind you something when it says, if a tree falls in a forest and nobody was there, did it make a sound?
Yes.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Science would say no. Why?
If there's nobody to hear it,
it never happened. If nobody measured and nobody watched it, it never happened. Never happened. It sounds like a nice philosophical assumption. But this is the basis of quantum physics. Of modern physics. That says what?
You know, why is it they're finding out that the world, the ground, everything is 4 million years old?
Just a second. Let's go again. The answer is here. Scientists realized, I'll give you an example. When a scientist is publishing a paper in a respectable scientific magazine, it's already a few decades, that the rules are very strict. That when you make the experiment, it has to be a double-blind experiment, which means that the people making the experiment have no idea what is a scientist expecting as a result. And they do not know what is the experiment and what is the control for the experiment. No idea. If the scientist is the one who is doing the experiment and he knows what is the control and what is the experiment itself, no one today will publish the paper. No matter how amazing is this discovery. Why? Because if a tree falls in a forest and nobody is there, it didn't make a sound. What does it mean? When we as human beings are present to an event, we are participating of making that event what it is. Which means, when it says that God saw that it was good, it means that everything that is happening needs a manifestation by somebody watching it. Now, if this is the story, it's a big, big secret. It's the biggest secret of the Torah itself. I'll give you another example. Rabbi Ashlag, the greatest Kabbalist of the of the 20th century, who wrote the commentary to the Zohar, the first big commentary that really puts everything together, and together with the Lurianic Kabbalah. And he said that the first secret that he learned from his teacher, his Kabbalistic master, was about a mikveh that was measured and found non-kosher. Okay? And that it made him so high. What makes you so high with, you know, learning about a mikveh that was measured and found non-kosher? Whoever learns from the Talmud, this law says as follows. Let's say a woman goes to the mikveh. A whole bunch of women go to the mikveh. They go usually, like the mikveh means the religious immersion in the water that the woman that had her, she had her menstruation, and then there was no bleeding, and then she counted 7 days without any bleeding, and then after this complete 7 days are over, she goes to a mikveh, which is a gathering of water, usually rainwater, and or a spring. She goes in and she bathes in when she's totally naked, after she really, really, really cleaned herself, and now she is pure, and before she was not pure. Now, in order for the mikveh to be kosher, it needs to have a minimal size that is something around a cubic meter. There's different ideas about between 600 meters to cubic meter. That's the minimum for a mikveh to be kosher. Now, let's say there was a mikveh, and women came to that mikveh, took a shower, scraped and cleaned everything and combed the hair, and they were totally clean after sitting half an hour in hot tub water. They're like shining from cleanliness, and they go in one after another, and let's say 5 women went into the mikveh. Then comes a guy, a rabbi comes, he says, I need to check, it's the time to check if there's enough water in the mikveh. And there are 10 more women standing in line. And he goes to check, enough water, there's not enough water in the mikveh. Now, of course, the women in line cannot go into that mikveh because it's not kosher. Right? It doesn't have enough water. Right? What about the women that already went into that mikveh? And they already went home to their husbands. They touched their husbands for 2 weeks already. Right? And now they went home. Should the rabbi or the mikveh lady run after these ladies and say, oh God, it's not kosher, come back to the mikveh, we filled it up and now you can... What is the law?
When she didn't know it.
When she didn't know it. So what do you think is the law? What do you think is the law?
There really isn't any law.
There is a law. The law says when they immerse in the mikveh and everybody was sure that the mikveh is kosher, the mikveh is kosher. Only when it was acknowledged as a non-kosher mikveh, it became non-kosher at that moment. Whatever happened before, it's kosher. What do we understand from that? Again, we come, if a tree fell in the forest and nobody was there, it didn't make a sound. We, human beings, when we came to earth, it says, in the image, in his image, in the image of God, he created him. Adam was created in the image of God, and we are the descendants of Adam. We were created in the image of God because we have the power of God. If we do not understand or realize that something happened, it did not happen. When we understand that something happens, it happens. And the way we understand it happens, that's how it happened. Is history telling us what really happened, or history is about what we remember from what happened? Many times, documents are coming and telling us that the way we remembered it, it never happened. But we live by what we remember that happened, not by what really happened. Correct? Same thing when something happens in our life. It affects us the way we decide it happened. Not by the way it really happened.
What is it?
It's all in our minds and our consciousness to decide if it happens or not, if it's good or not. And when it says, and God saw that it was good because it was good. And the moment He decided it's good, it is good. And when things happen to us, who decides if it is good or not?
We do.
We are the ones. Because we were created in the image of God. And therefore scientists realized some few decades ago, when the scientist is watching the experiment, even just by watching the experiment, he can affect the results of the experiment, although he does not touch it. Therefore, isn't that mystical? Isn't that mystical? So why is it in the most respectable scientific magazines? It's the first law that the scientist was not involved in the experiment, he did not watch it. Why? Because when he's present, he's affecting the results of the experiment. Just his presence. Just the presence of the scientist. Because once people said, oh, you have to be objective. You can be objective and you can watch what's going on and write objectively on what happens. Nobody can write objectively about anything that happened. Everybody who writes anything, everyone who describes anything has an opinion. Why? Because we are humans and something happens to us, we need to interpret it. And the moment we interpret it, we make it the way we interpret it. There's a story in the Talmud. In the Talmud, Tractate Ketubot. Tractate Brachot. The first tractate of the Talmud. It says about dreams. If in a dream you see a camel, it means so. If you see a date palm, it means so. If you see a river, it means so. But then it says as follows. There was this great sage. He had a dream. He lived in Jerusalem. He said 24 dream interpreters were in Jerusalem. You know, when you walk in New York, or many American cities, you see this like neon lights, psychic reader. You know what I'm talking about? Psychic reader. Yeah, in every American city, these kind of neon lights in the front of the on the window, psychic reader. So Jerusalem had 24 psychic readers for dream interpretations. Nothing different than New York or Los Angeles or Washington. So there was this guy who wanted to check it out. He was one of the great sages in the Talmud. He got up in the morning and had an amazing, beautiful, vivid, colorful dream. He went to all 24 dream interpreters in Jerusalem. Each one of them gave him a different interpretation. And all 24 interpretations came true. All 24 came true. What do you learn from that? That the way we interpret what we see, that's the way it's going to happen. So, when something happens, whatever happens is nonsense. Till we give it a sense. Now, who's the one to give it sense?
We are.
Depends. Sometimes we give it to others. Right? Something happens to us, and we allow everybody else to say, oh, it's a disaster. Oh, it failed. You know the people that allow others to do that to them? They do not go far. Right? They do not go far. The winners, the people really know to achieve success, They are the ones that whatever happens, they do not allow anyone to tell them it's a failure. They are the ones who say, good. Because it says, and God saw it was good. When a person is a winner, when a person is a happy, successful person, it's because he realizes that he was created in the image of God. So if I am created in the image of God, whatever happens, it comes from God. But it's nonsense. Because God created us in His image, so we complete the creation. So whatever happens has no sense till we give it a sense. We are the ones who are supposed to give it a sense. That's why this chapter of Bereshit, the story of Bereshit, is to teach us, to educate us, that we are the creators of our lives. Whatever happens to us, we are the ones and the only ones. Never ever let anyone else do it for you. To decide what really happened. Because the way I remember what happened, that's the way it's going to be. And if whatever happened, let's say I invested in a certain business and I lost this business, I can say that was a big failure. You can say that was a big lesson. I learned from it a lot, and I just learned how to be more successful the next time. It's my choice. It is my choice. When the stock market is falling, everybody's losing money? No. There are many people who make a lot of money. The ones who sell in the beginning and buy in the end, that because in every crash, there are a lot of people making a lot of money. Because the ones who sell first and buy last, they're the ones who just, what do? They simply clean up. Not just clean up. They basically use all the fools to decide, it's a disaster, it's a disaster. Okay. You sell it, it's a disaster. So, you get it very cheap, I'll buy it, and then the price will go up, and you fools will go and buy it again. And I'll make money again because I'll sell it back to you, but now much more expensive. Isn't that the way it is?
Yes.
In the stock market, and people still do the same stupidity. They're always the people that lose and all the people make money. It's not true that everybody's losing money in the crashes. No, a lot of people become very rich just on these moments.
The shrewd ones.
Who are the ones? They are the ones who see it's an opportunity. Whatever happens, they're no disasters. So why do you have to look at the shrewd one and say, you know, why can't I behave like that? Why can't I look at everything that happens and say, it's only opportunity. I'm going only to become stronger and smarter and more experienced from that what happened. It only made me stronger and more certain about my success. And you know, the people do say that. That's what they do. You know what about the prophecy that fulfills itself? You're going to say that you're a failure and you're a failure and you're a failure. You're going to be a failure. If you're going to say that you're a success story, you're going to become a success story. Because if you behave like one, you'll be one. That's the way. So this world, we learn over here. We learn that God created that light, that treasured light. What is this light? So we learn in Kabbalah that without this light we can't live it even a second. This is the light of life. It's not a physical light, it's not coming and not from the moon. This light is coming from the Creator Himself. Now why does He say that it is treasured? Because how much light of God is there in the universe? Endless. Yeah. How many people do see that light? Very few.
Mystics.
All the rest are busy running after their own tail. Looking for what? You see them running on the streets. You know, I'm going to make one more penny, one more dollar, one more ruble, one more whatever, pound or euro, whatever. They're just running. And you know, if it's not money, it is fame, it is whatever. And I'm never happy. Because the only way for a person to become happy is to be the light, to be a creator. Because the light is deep inside, it's treasured. Treasured inside. What's the difference between treasure and garbage? Garbage you throw in the street. Treasure is that is locked behind. It's not easy to get. Right? It's not easy to get. So why is it not easy to get? Because the Kabbalists explain. When the universe has been created, it was endless light. We got that endless light. Remember, if somebody is endless sharer and giver, He's no one unless there's somebody to receive. So that's how God created us, so we can receive. Then we received, and then what was the problem? We had so much endless light. We became the light. We wanted to share also. We wanted to be creators also. Therefore, we created that dark world that is called our world. That here, there's so much darkness. You can create light in any corner. How? You can create on your own. You can be in the deepest misery and say, there must be hope. There must be hope. You know what? Those people humanity remembers, and the people that rot in their own juices of self-pity, nobody remembers them. They just get lost in the oblivion. Correct? Because the purpose of creation of mankind is that we till the ground. That we, and there was no Adam to till the ground and to water the fields. Everything that was created in the creation was there, and nothing was there. It became, so when we say when a tree falls in the forest and nobody is there, was there a tree? Was there a forest? Was there any sound? Nothing. Only when someone came and sits there. And that's what scientists are saying. That the human consciousness is creating reality. So if my consciousness is creating reality, I'll better create a good one. So my choice as a creator, as a co-creator, is whatever happens to me to say, how do I create a good one out of it? How do I make good out of it? Because that's the purpose of my creation. Because the moment I create and I say, I don't know, I don't see, I don't understand, but I know it's going to come out good because I decided so. I'm going to work for it. I'm going to fight for it. Till it's going to come out good. You know what happens? People do that. They also deserve to connect to the treasured light. Because they said, let there be light. And if you say, let there be light, you got the key to the treasure. The treasure that everyone is running after. And it's not in the money, and it's not in the gold, and not in the silver, and not in the jewelry, it's not in the fancy houses, and it's not in the food. It is in our hearts. Because everything that we see around is nonsense till we put light into it. And how? By saying, let there be light. By realizing that we are co-creators, that God created everything till the last. But the last point, he didn't create. Till, but not until. He created everything till the last point and let us finish the job. By saying, it is good. And God said that it was good. When we do that, it's not being optimistic. It's being realistic. Realizing that this is the main most important rule of the creation. Because it's very simple. No matter what happens to a person, if the person says there must be a good reason it happened, and it happened for good reason, and you know, it, no matter what, he will find a good reason. But if a person said, oh, that's a disaster, it will be a disaster. Remember that. Before you jump into conclusion, if something happened, it was good or bad, remember what I said. I didn't invent it. That's the basics of Bereshit. We're here to create good. When we create good, we deserve to receive the treasured light. That's our choice, to choose evil or good. It's our choice. We create the good and the evil. And therefore, when you ask the question, so what does it say that the world was created a few billion years ago? How long? Didn't we say that when a tree falls in the forest, if there's nobody there, it doesn't make a sound? If there was a creation a billion years ago, 20 billion years, and there was nobody there to see it, did it really
make a note of it?
Did it really happen? And therefore, when if you read in the Talmud or in the Zohar, when it says that this year is 5770, they don't say it's 5770 from the creation. It's 1570, from the moment there was a human being to say, oh, there is a world, then time started. Because is there a time when there's nobody to be aware of it? According to what we said, according to modern science, there's no time. Thank God we can teach Kabbalah today, because people can understand, because the scientists said it's okay. Right? Before the scientists said it's okay, you can tell it before you talk Kabbalah, people say, oh, you go crazy. Because if you speak like this to people who do not understand science, they think you're crazy. What, you want to tell me if I say it was good, it will be good? You know what? Yes. Look at all the winners and the people who really, really know what does it mean success. That's how they made success. They turned other people's failure into their victory.
Is it not optimism and pessimism?
I won't say optimism and pessimism, because both of them is pessimism. An optimistic says it's going to be all great, so I don't need to do anything. And a pessimistic says it's anyway terrible, there's nothing I can do about it. Both are passive. Right? A real winner and a real success person is a person that always looks around to see where there's a spot of darkness that he can shine and make light out of it. Because, and that always sounds right. Why? Because we were created in the image of God. So we get connected to the treasured light. That's the light that we feel when we feel that we did something right. That we fulfilled ourselves with a meaning. When we turn the darkness into light. How? Just by saying, oh, I see darkness. Great. That's an opportunity to bring light. In that moment, you become a creator. And if you truly believe in that, you truly make it happen. We are the magical creator, and that's the lesson of this parasha. If not, it's terrible. So Cain will kill Abel. Abel was terrible because he was killed. Cain was terrible because he killed, right?
What's the mark of Cain?
There are all kinds of stories about the mark of Cain, but it doesn't matter. It's like, the point is that when a person does not see that it's all about himself, don't wait for God. Why Cain killed Abel? He thought that God loved Abel's sacrifice like his. You know, that's the biggest first sin. The big first sin was that Adam said, the woman you gave me, she made me do that. That's a real big first sin. Why? The moment I blame somebody else, what do? Remember, when you point at somebody else, one finger points the woman, but then the thumb points at God. You gave me, right? But how many fingers point at me? How many? Look at my hand.
Three.
So the majority says, who should take responsibility? Me. When I stop, when I refuse to take responsibility, I am not a creator anymore. I'm not in the image of God anymore. I open the door to all the possible darkness, because then everything can become terrible. The moment we start to blame somebody else, we're not blaming others. That's the most terrible thing. Because you become a victim, you become miserable, you're justifying hurting the others. It's hell on earth. It's all starting from blaming. Okay? Then, Cain, he killed Abel because it looked like God loved Abel's sacrifice. He didn't like his. You wait for somebody else's approval? That's a second big sin. Because what's wrong about waiting for somebody else's approval? In that moment, we allow that person to become my creator. In that moment, I'm not the image of God anymore, like blaming. The moment I hand over the control over my life to someone else, it's over. I'm not the creator anymore. I cannot fulfill the purpose of me walking on earth. The purpose is to realize I was created in the image of God. And my life is under my responsibility. The moment I'm waiting for his approval, he becomes the cause, I'm the effect. The moment I blame somebody else, he becomes the cause, I'm the effect. Can I be a creator if I'm not the cause? So no wonder, in that moment, you go into the land of darkness. the eternal darkness. There's no light over there. Only darkness. You want to go back to the land of light? You have to create the light. How do you create the light? You realize that you are the only one who can create the light. So you're not waiting anymore. What was the problem of waiting for the Messiah? It's thousands of years didn't come yet. Because the moment you wait for someone, he will never come. Especially the Messiah. What is the Messiah? The Messiah, the Kabbalists explain, is when we, as humanity, realize that it's our job to bring in the light. To be a creator. That's a Messiah. The moment we don't blame anyone anymore, the moment we learn to take responsibility and we learn the magical powers we have, then whatever dream we have, whatever happens to us, it will manifest exactly the way we decide to perceive it. And when you train yourself more and more to do that, you realize that that's the secret of the real, true success. And that's what the whole story of the Torah will be from now, with different variations. Thank you.